Welcome back to The Clean Close, the place for all you real estate news junkies like me. The industry continues to be on fuego. Redfin gets dragged into the courtroom brawl between Zillow and Compass. Continued outrage regarding the Compass Anywhere merger. Is it backlash? Is it forward lash? Who knows? NAR is facing open rebellion from the brokers it claims to represent. Today we're asking, is this the great real estate reset? All that and some special guests on this edition of The Clean Close. The portal war drama continues. Okay, Housing Wire has reported that Redfin has officially been pulled into the Zillow Compass lawsuit. Here's what's happening. Zillow announced that ban on private listings, which we all know about, saying every property must now be publicly marketed in order to appear on the platform. So days after Zillow announced its policy change, Redfin rolled out its own policy, almost identical. The twist is that Redfin actually hasn't started enforcing it yet. And they say it's because of their pending Rocket Homes acquisition, which is complicating the rollout. But Compass is saying that Redfin's CEO drafted a blog about the Zillow policy before Zillow had announced it publicly. And it is implying that there might have been some coordination, that Redfin might have had advanced knowledge of the ban. And then there's a witness, an agent who allegedly received direction about accessing Zillow data from her Compass manager. According to the court filings, quote, the agent will explain that she received instructions from her Compass manager about how to access listing data on Zillow and that other agents in her community have. It suggests that there might be a data misuse issue here, but really, as always, it's about who controls the digital front door to our market, right? And when Zillow and Compass and Redfin are all operating as brokerages, the lines are starting to blur. Like, are we competitors? Are we collaborators? So we're gonna wait and see what the courts say, but it's interesting now that we've got Redfin pulled into the Zillow Compass lawsuit. I'll keep you posted. Okay, the fallout from the Compass and Anywhere acquisition is continuing. Inman published this week an open letter from Robert Refkin, the CEO of Compass, who remains in our news headlines. Okay, he gave a list of kind of reassurances, right? He made bullet points about what his, what things he can promise. Some of the things that he says include, he says, we're going to preserve the Better Homes and Gardens real estate, Century 21, Coldwell Banker, Corcoran, ERA, and Sotheby's International Realty brands for both company-owned and franchise brokerages. He says that you'll continue to have the same independence if you're a franchise owner. You'll remain fully in charge of how you run your business. He says he'll make the technology platform available to company-owned brokerages and franchise owners, giving you the tools to use the choice to use the tools that best support you. And then one of his lines, and this is the one that kind of set people afire, is you and your sellers will always have the freedom to choose how each listing is marketed and sold. So James Dwiggins, one of my favorites, he posts these things on Facebook and then people just go crazy in the comments. So one of the comments on his post was like, translation, we will continue to invest in our systems, but we will not invest in improving Anywhere systems. Another one says, this is from Russ Lagan, destroy openness and transparency for our own company's gain. Yep, exactly. Make it harder for buyers to find all listings. Yep, that too. Clear cooperation makes it best for consumers and agents. Destroying that is insane. So there's one fan of clear cooperation. Then Stephanie Martin Velez says, I see a lawsuit in their future. Someone is going to complain that they were coerced and were not informed of their options. Susanna Higuera Murphy, hi Susanna. One of my team members went above and beyond for her buyers this week by reaching out to a friend at Compass to inquire about those exclusive listings. Now, I don't know if you guys remember, but Maybe a year ago, Compass released this thing saying, you can access our private listings even if you're not a Compass agent. And then it encouraged people to kind of sign up like agents from other firms. One agent at our firm actually tried to sign up to get access to the private listing network. And apparently there was no there there. It seemed like maybe it was just kind of a public relations thing or a marketing scheme. We're not sure. So one of my team members went above and beyond for her buyers this week by reaching out to a friend at Compass to inquire about their exclusive listings, only to discover that those listings aren't accessible to agents outside Compass. Right. She was told that the only way to find out about these off-market opportunities would be to physically visit each office, each local office, and check with each agent. Needless to say, her clients had a disadvantage, but more so I think of all the sellers that could potentially be matching with this buyer, but would never know this due to the three-phase off-market strategy. And that is the concern, right? The concern is that buyers are not getting access to all the available listings. And somehow sellers have been sold on this idea that keeping it off-market benefits them somehow. So how does it benefit them? Does it benefit them because they can set a really high price and maybe some random buyer in the Compass network is gonna find it? We know that if it's sold off market and Compass is representing both buyer and seller, that Compass is going to get, you know, the commission for both sides of the transaction. Usually I follow the money when it comes to these things, but it's like, why is there a perceived benefit to the seller that is so easily sold about putting it on this strategy? And in the past, of course, we've heard they say, well, you can test a price without burning days on market, so kind of gaming the system that way. Maybe there's a reason like a holiday delay or nobody wants to list during Christmas, but you still want to sell. Maybe the house is sitting vacant. And if you can get the right price, I don't know. There could be a million ways to do this. But now that the MLS has this other option in there, you could be marketing still if it's off market, so to speak, like not publicly available on Zillow and Redfin. It could still appear in the MLS and be marketed to more agents. I don't think a lot of agents are using that tab or that search feature though. Jack Gervon says, or the translation could be, my commitment is to the shareholders of Compass, not to agents, sellers, or buyers. So that's another accusation that has been levied at Compass, that they're making decisions that are not necessarily in the best interest of buyers and sellers, but more in this pursuit of market power and in this pursuit of market share that has been at the core of their business from the very beginning. But does it benefit buyers and sellers, or is it really just answering to like never satisfied shareholders? Somebody, Grady Ligon, said, read my lips, no new taxes. And then somebody else wrote, the middle ground solution that I believe is viable is to allow brokerages to pre-market the property. But if the seller chooses to pre-market the property, then the agent or broker is bound to not accept any offers for a period of 1 to 2 weeks after it's publicly listed. This will allow the market exposure and other agents to come in with their offers and eliminate any possible lawsuits from pocket listings. But that defeats the purpose. And also, if you're gonna pre-market and then burn a couple of extra weeks also on the market, it's like, why not just go to market, right? I know everybody knows days on market is an important piece of data, even though it's super flawed the way we enter it into our MLS here. But people know that the longer a property appears to be on the market, the less market power that property has. It's perceived to be overpriced or not wanted, or maybe there's something wrong. I've had clients ask me, why has it been on the market so long? What's wrong with it? But to me, this is one of those middle ground solutions that really doesn't solve the problem. Is there an actual benefit? Is it truly seller choice to market a listing off market, or is it more of a marketing scheme for the brokerage? And then somebody very, very clever wrote, this reminds me of another announcement. Back in March 2015, Zillow made a pledge in Inman and publicly, stating that they would never become a brokerage. It says, Zillow makes formal pledge not to be a brokerage or an MLS. Deal to secure listings from nation's largest MLS reinforces Zillow's public stance. Here's what they said. Zillow has consistently maintained that it does not want to be in the brokerage or MLS business. But CEO Spencer Raskoff's observation that agents might be willing to pay up to 40% of their commissions for well-qualified leads and last year's launch of Coming Soon listings have raised suspicions from some quarters that Zillow has been eager to quell. So you can't believe any of their public statements because they change their mind all the time. And we just make our choices based on what they're publicly saying. I know Zillow has been making a lot of appearances on podcasts lately, talking about their lawsuits, talking about their one ecosystem. But, there is a deeper agenda here and not one that they would probably publicly say anywhere. It's all just kind of saving face in light of increased suspicion. I would suggest now around Compass, Zillow, and Redfin, lest we forget the Zillow-Redfin rent advertising lawsuit, right? So I guess the question is, what's gonna happen? I'm excited to speak with our guest today to talk about that because it seems that some brokerages are trying to fine-tune the model of the past and some are throwing it away altogether and creating something different that could be the future of brokerages. We need to look at both and see which is actually the direction our industry is heading so we can make the appropriate decisions and decide whether or not we are going to get a job as a waitress. There's an NAR revolt. Real Estate News this week announced that a new coalition of independent brokers, some former NAR insiders, is demanding a complete overhaul of the National Association of Realtors. It's called the Pro-Agent Restore Trust in NAR Working Group. And it's made up of apparently top secret, top brokerage execs representing over 100,000 agents, supposedly. And they delivered a letter to the CEO of NAR, Nakia Wright, and they had some questions and some demands. Let's go through them. They are calling for revision or destruction of the clear cooperation policy. They are calling for, a re-examination of the three-way agreement. So the three-way agreement is the requirement that realtors have to join state, local, and national associations, and that is mandatory. They're saying that there's a legal risk there. Transparency with regard to the NAR restructuring plan. So I'll get to that in a second, but essentially NAR is like, we're gonna restructure. We're gonna be more financially transparent. We're gonna do things a little differently, but no one's seen the plan. And there have been some demands for the plan. And NAR is saying that we'll see something in 2026. But remember how long it took for them to even respond to the clear cooperation policy challenges. So who knows if that's going to be true or not. A revision to the governance structure, as in they want some independence in that structure. A close look at the NAR budget and balance sheet. This one, when I saw the numbers, I was like, oh my Lanta. And disclosure of financial interests in Second Century Ventures and how the subsidiary benefits NAR members. I didn't even know about this. Did you know about this? I didn't even know about this. We're gonna get into it. Okay, so Dan Duffy, he is of United Real Estate. He's the spokesperson for this group. He shared the letter that he wrote to NAR with Real Estate News, but he refused to share NAR's response. He said NAR can speak for themselves. So they asked NAR if they wanted to share their response. NAR refused to share their response. Transparency much? I don't think so. This is looking very Epstein to me. Anyway, NAR pointed to a, quote, member success-focused value proposition, unquote, which makes me wonder if they are changing to a member success-focused value proposition now. What the hell was it before? Who were you serving? I mean, who are you serving? It's crazy to me that that is the new change. So with regard to the clear cooperation policy, we all know that that policy was flawed from the beginning. There are some people, like that person in the comments, who's kind of still a fan. Okay, I understand the intention was good. Like, make all listings available to all people on the MLS, but off-market listings were never illegal. It was only through clear cooperation policy that there were loopholes created, that this private listing marketplace was created by Compass and other bigger brokerages, never with the success of Compass with regards to that. But this policy created problems and, in my opinion, should have been thrown away a long time ago. But alas, it's just caused us a bunch of lawsuits. So in the letter, Duffy and his working group told NAR it believed the clear cooperation policy, quote, exposes NAR brokerages and agents to future litigation. I agree. And the new multiple listing options for sellers policy, which introduced a delayed marketing option, doesn't alleviate that risk. That was my beef too. I'm like, this is a halfway point. This is a nothing thing. It's a nothing burger. So what, we can delay listings going on the MLS and put them in our MLS? We can, but if agents aren't using that feature, it doesn't have the same impact at all. And they're not. I doubt there's widespread adoption of that feature at all. People don't understand it. It seems like unnecessary. You're either on or off market or on a private listing network. It's like, that's it. The group noted that none of its members were included in the meetings that gave rise to the new policy. Fair point. I've been fighting this policy for years and years. And why I started to fight it is because I felt like at the local and state level, my voice as an independent broker wasn't heard. So this was not something that was created with the consent of the majority, I don't think. This is like certain rulemakers sitting in a room. And when you see how many people, there are 1,000 member volunteers at NAR. By member volunteers, it means people who are willing to serve on committees. There are 95 committees, forums, councils, and boards. Have you ever been on a Zoom with 100 people trying to make a decision? That's how our policies, I think, are being made. I've sat in on a few of these committee sessions, and I'm always shocked by how many people there are. And I'm like, what qualifies all these people to be making decisions that affect such a vast majority of agents in America? Okay, from our perspective, this is on the three-way. From our perspective, tying agreements like these are not appropriate, especially when the parties have monopolistic control over access to a market. So the whole time that we've been under this mandate to join NAR, CAR, or your state association and your local association, we've had no choice. It's the old guard. They do serve us, right? There are things that they do that are helpful, like forms and education and that kind of thing. But could we not be served by one of them, I think? Could CAR not be the statewide publications and education? After all, licensing is at the state level. And if our national association is collecting our fees, but still creating policies that subject us to lawsuits and continued lawsuits, and with many people when they got sued at the beginning of 2 years ago, they were left behind by NAR. There was no defense. And as an agent, there is no public relations campaign for our reputation, just a bunch of black eyes in the press. I know I've mentioned this a million times, but it hurt my feelings when a trusted journalist from the New York Times went on Morning Joe and said the 6%, which again, I know we're not supposed to talk about it, but this was in the lawsuit, so I'm talking about what this guy said, not an industry standard. And in fact, in my experience, it's not an industry standard. Commissions have always been negotiable, but whatever. He said it's like a tax on Americans. A tax. My job is a tax on Americans. While these attorneys run away with the bag on all of these lawsuits anyway. So the monopoly that NAR has had and this three-way policy is real, but it's starting to change. And what's going to change it? Why do we have to join these organizations? We joined to get access to the MLS. And now the MLS, I think, has to give access, showing Supra lockbox access to non-NAR members. So as those little pieces of the old guard start to disassemble, you're seeing the emergence of potentially new data and listing portals that could replace the MLS. And if they replace the MLS, then why do I need to join the MLS? I don't. And if I don't need access to the MLS, whether it's for access to listings or access to data, then really CAR, NAR, and the local association need to very clearly defend their value to most of the members. This is why these guys are taking this to NAR. They're like, this is your last chance before the entire industry takes off and leaves you behind. Okay, so for governance, NAR has a paid leadership team of 8 people, okay? But a board of directors, the 1,000 member volunteers, 95 committees, forums, councils, and boards, okay? But no true independent board members. So what they say is, quote, independent governance is the cornerstone of all high-performing, on-purpose organizations. And without it, organizational drift occurs at best, and fiduciary alignment breaks down at worst. That's a big statement. That is a big statement. The balance sheet, the NAR balance sheet. NAR ended 2022 with, get this, can you guess? Can you guess? $1 billion in assets. $1 billion in assets. You know what I could do with $1 billion of assets? Or what I could do with my dues money that I've paid over the past 20 years sitting in a savings account or being invested in a tax-free account, savings account? $747 million in net assets. By the end of 2023, the year NAR suffered the loss in the landmark Sitzer-Burnett trial, and I'm reading from the article now, the net assets had diminished to $363 million. Okay. So what the working group is saying is that the balance sheet for NAR makes them a target for lawsuits. Lowering agent fees for a set number of years would show that NAR is aligned with its affiliated agents and the challenges they face in a challenging market. I'm reading. Reimburse a portion of the legal and settlement costs incurred by brokerages not covered by NAR's settlement. And offer a dividend to agents whose dues collectively exceeded NAR's working capital needs. I don't know how they would accomplish number 2 and 3. I don't know what the accounting for would be for the legal and settlement costs incurred by brokerages not covered by NAR's settlement. And I don't think it's fair to assert that NAR members, as if we're like tax paying members, but we're dues paying members of this association, should be required to pay for legal and settlement fees for non-member brokerages. So I totally take issue with that. I don't even know how they came up with that. Would love to hear a defense on that. Offer a dividend to agents whose dues collectively exceed. And how about we just reduce what we're spending or spend it more strategically, stop charging us an arm and a leg, and let agents keep more of their money. That would instill some trust, I think. So here's another thing I didn't know. Who knew? During its meeting with NAR leaders, the group said it was told by a representative of SCV, NAR's for-profit venture. So NAR has a for-profit venture capital arm called Second Century. And they said, apparently the NAR leader said, NAR has little to do with Second Century and there are no economic threads that connect NAR, former executives or current executives or staffs to their investments and interest, unquote. This working group asked the CEO, Nakia Wright, to confirm that. And it is unclear whether or not she did or not. But what this makes people feel like is that there is a self-enrichment practice at NAR, and again, I'm sort of paraphrasing from the article, and NAR doesn't benefit. So our money is being used to fund a private for-profit venture capital arm for which we are not beneficiaries that I didn't even know about. Should they not have to disclose this? I mean, this is part of what is leading to this distrust. So whenever people like Jason Haber, who I adore, say, you know, maybe NAR needs more members, we need more members because it has actually got an agenda. And that agenda is to collect as much money as it can from licensees throughout the country in order to fund, perhaps, its for-profit venture capital arm or its deep balance sheet. Where is that money being spent? When do we ever get to see that? It's a lot. So to me, this is amazing. Even though I don't agree with everything, it at least is bringing up questions that will determine the future of the association. And as I have said in the past, I think we need one place where we all can kind of coagulate and share our thoughts on what's going on in the industry and use the network of leadership that we have to help us survive when our industry, I feel like, is under attack. Here's a little Instagram video for you. Let's see what Instagram has to say about it.
Okay, if you're in real estate, this is actually really big news in the industry as 15 top-level executives representing over 100,000 agents have come together to form this group to basically hold NAR, the National Association of Realtors, accountable for what they think, since this landmark lawsuit in our industry, what they think is the trade organization basically coming out with some changes in the beginning to appease their membership, because they talked about accountability and they talked about transparency and a tightening of the belt. And they think they made some changes in the beginning to appease their membership, but behind the scenes, they really haven't been doing that much. Now, the spokesperson for these 15 top-level executives is Dan Duffy, the CEO of United Real Estate, who I'm fortunate enough, that's a friend, they're a client. And so I had a chance to talk to him to really get into the details of what it is they're saying and what it is we need to be paying attention to. And if you're in real estate, you need to pay attention to what I'm about to go over.
Some of the main points they talk about, this isn't all of them, but this is some of them, is the inadequacy of the clear cooperation policy. We can talk about that. The need for more transparency around NAR's restructuring deal, an absolutely bloated balance sheet, which, you know, he kind of details spending that's still occurring online on the road. But the main one here is this legal risk of the three-way agreement, which requires NAR members to join local, state, and national realtor associations if they want to join at any level, and usually to also join their local MLS, which they need to do their job. And that is a big one. So here's the real issue. Nakia Wright, the CEO of NAR, the National Association of Realtors, when asked at a meeting in DC recently about all of the scrutiny and everything on the industry and herself and the organization since she took over, said that every storm runs out of rain, which means eventually people will move on and they'll back off and whatever. And that's a problem, because that three-way deal, which requires many people across this country, many agents, to be a part of the NAR, National Association of Realtors, in order to be a part of their local or to have access to their MLS, which they need to actually do their job, that is the easiest antitrust lawsuit in the history of the world. And Dan Duffy's point in all of this was to understand what a hurricane rain band is, meaning many times when the rain hits before the hurricane, you think that's the hurricane, when really that's the rain before the hurricane. And if we don't, within the industry, fix this whole three-way agreement thing, what's going to happen is that lawsuit that happened a little bit ago is only going to be the rain, and the hurricane is still coming, and we still have a chance to fix within the industry if we actually get accountable and care about change.
If NAR can't rebuild trust, it will be replaced. Quotes. This isn't outsiders throwing stones. This is insiders saying what we have is a cracked foundation. We have a cracked foundation. And when an organization that is built on trust starts losing it, that's not a PR crisis. That's an extinction event, y'all. We have to make bigger moves to save our industry, to save our association, to save our way of doing things, or we're going to have to surrender to the future. Check out this reel.
AI will replace over 50% of the real estate agents in the next 3 years. Most real estate agents are still in play mode, so how they use ChatGPT is very conversational. Whereas top real estate agents are starting to use AI by the minute. It's now becoming a level of functionality in their business. You can implement AI into your real estate business is like this. This is exactly what my top agents are doing. They input the address and the neighborhood into ChatGPT, and then they use this exact prompt. I just took this listing. Tell me the highlights of the neighborhood. Pull demographic data for this neighborhood. I'm trying to find the ideal buyer. Be able to market to. If I live there, what would the lifestyle be? What are the school ratings? Identify cons to living in this neighborhood and identify objection handlers for those cons. Craft a modern marketing plan for this listing. Play the role of expert marketer and top listing agent. Goal is to get as many offers as possible. Add a neighborhood farming strategy for the listing. Based on that prompt, it's going to give you a full analysis of the neighborhood so that you'll be able to understand the target buyer for that listing. This is going to help you create and craft a story to get as many buyers through that front door as possible. Then implement your marketing plan.
If you have a product or service you think our audience would love to learn about, please DM me at IG at The Clean Close. I would be happy to consider all of our voices. Hit the like, comment, or subscribe button and support your girl. Now back to the show. Parker Bryant, CEO and founder of Housewell, a new tech-forward discount real estate brokerage, recently posted a Substack called Why Real Estate Agents Aren't Going Away Anytime Soon. While that headline seems encouraging, the brokerage he founded is actually going to be a challenge for an establishment brokerage. He says he can cut agent commissions by 2/3 and deliver what we're going to find out is the same level of service. So he's here on The Clean Clothes to discuss his article. Welcome, Parker.
Hey, Courtney. Glad to
be
here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you here. So I read your Substack. I thought it was really great, really thoughtful. Well done. We're calling this episode The Great Real Estate Reset, okay? Because it feels like we're at this fork in the road in the industry where either these big titans of industry are going to all, you know, turn into the great real estate blob, like the Compass Anywhere blob, and that's going to determine the future of how real estate is done, or we may lean into something more like what it is then that you're doing. And, you know, you argue that existing brokerages are bloated, right? That they're mm-hmm. outdated and they're built to serve the company, not the consumer. So I'm curious to know from you, what do you think is the biggest yesterday problem that you see brokerages still clinging to?
There's a lot of stuff that all adds up. I really empathize with independent agents and independent brokers and the challenge of running their businesses today, because there's so many, and you mentioned this in your last episode, there's so many outstretched hands that kind of want a piece of that gross commission, and it can sure. just sort of run you over how many expenses there are about running your business, right? There's the local association, there's the state association, there's the national association, there's the MLS, there's your broker split as a local agent that you have to pay. I think the Great Reset is a really interesting like angle, because it seems like a lot of the stuff needs to get reshuffled.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think that the future, like what you're creating, is a networked brokerage, which is lean, transparent, and tech driven. So what do you do to like cut those commissions and still have your agents making a living?
Right. Yeah, so our model is a little different. And two, like our whole, we have a sort of a particular niche. So almost 80% of our business is fix and flippers and investors. So we started off with the retail angle, and we still sell normal, you know, regular people's homes and help them buy as well. But we have that recurring revenue of flippers and investors that allows us to, they'll sell 5 or 10 houses with us a year, and that allows our economics to be much better. And then also we have our own in-house tech team, so we don't have to pay for as many subscription services and all that adds up over time. And because we're cheaper, our conversion rate's a little bit better probably than your average brokerage too. It's a little bit of a standout thing. So when we go to a listing appointment and we say, hey, we'll save you 12 grand and it's just a regular person, that helps us win more deals.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you train your agents? Are they trained on reading the contracts? Are they trained on jumping hurdles? Do you find that you attract a lot of rookie agents?
Mm. Well, so most of our agents, the bulk of their compensation comes from salary. We have sort of like, it's, our structure is a little different. We have the people who work the deals are what we call listing managers, and they're agents who've been in the field for a while. They know their stuff. They're good agents, but maybe they're good at real estate, but less good at sales. It's a little bit like the Redfin model, where they've done a bunch of transactions, but they don't have a huge sphere of influence to use as like a good base for their sales. So we pay them a monthly salary, and then they also get commissions for closed deals. And then we have purely salespeople. And those people are all about generating outbound and setting listing appointments. So it's a slightly different
compensation. Who's hosting the open houses?
Shoami. Have you heard of Shoami?
So you're using a third party to host the open houses?
For most listings, depending on what plan you're... If you're using just the $3,500 flat fee plan, then Shoami shows the open house. And then if you use the premium plan, then the local agent in your area who's doing your transaction will host the open house.
Oh, so there's a premium for an agent that you've like met with in person and vetted somehow to host your actual open house.
Right. That's between 1% and 2% commission. instead of 3,500 is the standard plan that most of our investor clients use.
Right, because the investors think, hey, you know, the house is going to sell itself. I know these people. I've worked with these investors before. They think the agent doesn't matter. In fact, recently on a telephone call that I had with some investors, you know, one of them was like, I have my license. I can just put it on myself, as if the work of the agent, the expertise, the experience of the agent is actually quite valueless and you just stick it on the MLS and it goes. I think this is the public perception that we experienced real estate agents who really do have an expertise in this field have been like battling against since the advent of tech in our sales space. And, you know, whether it's communicating to clients that agents are more than just door openers, which is what Zillow really loves to have, like a little minion group of door openers, to something more like this, where with ShowAmi, there's no, you don't know who's going to be hosting. You don't know if they're great with buyers. You don't know if they get sign-in. You don't know if they do follow-up. You have really no idea if they're selling your house or just trying to pick up a client. There's no quality control. So how do you do quality control if you're outsourcing the very consumer interfacing job of like open house? How do you make sure that the people you're choosing are doing a good job of that?
Well, in at least in Atlanta, there are a few like power ShowAmi users. So it's some familiar faces that we see recurring. So we built somewhat of a relationship with some of the local ShowAmi agents, and they pass the list back to us for follow-up. But I mean, that's a fair critique. And I'm not anti-agent. I think we started off even more tech forward, and we've slowly crept up in prices and crept down in technology. And we'll probably even go higher in prices next year and have more agent influence as well next year.
This is one of the things that when I read your article, I was like, he gets it. Because when you talk about the irreplaceability of agents, you mentioned psychology. Psychology is something that is a huge part of our job. And that is helping people play to win on a house they really love when they're afraid of overpaying, or helping a seller come to terms with the reality of a market when it feels very disappointing to them. For example, sellers in this market are not, they'll do a lot of beautiful work to a house. I also work with a lot of renovation resale artists, so I'm with you. I know beautiful houses used to sell themselves, but in this market, you have to do a little bit more. They have to be higher quality design. They have to be, you know, systems upgrades throughout. There has to be somebody who really knows the neighborhood and really can really share more value when you're on site. Really, the job of sales right now is for the muscular. It's for the people who have been working in this industry, and the people who can't cut it are the ones who end up taking salary jobs, team jobs, or the ones who are taking hourly pay, you know, like a ShowAmi agent. These are the ones who don't have the sphere of influence. I've lost agents to Redfin because they just didn't have enough of their own book of business. And entities like Redfin and perhaps like yours were willing to, you know, satisfy that need for income. You know, otherwise they'd have to get another job. So I'm not saying that there's not probably in a market like this a potential agent for that job. But is the seller, is the consumer, is the buyer, are they being served well? And one of the other things that you mentioned with creating this platform was that you feel like companies like mine, perhaps, or maybe not mine because I'm too small to compete in that space, but like big companies like a Compass or Coldwell Banker or something, you know, that they're all about the company dollar. And I don't disagree with you. There is a place where when you're working at those firms, they are pressuring you to use their ancillary services, which is an income generator. They're pressuring you to use their preferred lenders. There's pressure on the agent to use all these services that they provide because it generates revenue for the company, and not necessarily it's in the best interest of the consumer. But when it comes to actual sales, I don't see how a discount model, even if you think you're selling a third commission to a prospective list a seller, you know, as a reasonable fee, how you're not necessarily costing them money because the agent that's actually doing the sales is inexperienced and is a discount agent who doesn't really understand the value of the project or the money, and there's no quality control. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is I think there are different products for different segments of the market. We've made a foray into some luxury transactions, and honestly, their expectations of white glove service and what they expect out of an agent is different. Mm-hmm. I think luxury agents are definitely not going to be under threat at all from companies like ours. I mean, at the margin, there will be people who want to save money. But at the same time, I think we can both agree that the expenses that are taken out of a housing transaction, not just agents, but mortgage brokerage commission. I mean, title insurance is the biggest, like it's just insane how much profit margin these title insurance companies have. It just becomes too much for consumers. And we were talking about how agents get run over with costs. The consumers do too. I mean, the median family in America buying a $500,000 house, if you can say, here's $8,000 of the agent's commission, maybe the sales process is slightly worse. I think our team does an excellent job in every transaction. But if you can say, here's $8,000, we'll split it 4,000 seller, 4,000 buyer, that's compelling to a lot of customers. And that's maybe they care more about that than maybe all the little details that a more traditional brokerage might focus on.
Well, I mean, the buyers and the sellers are going to have to pay title insurance. It's not a matter of do they have to pay it. They have to pay it. Most of, if there's a lender involved, there's a title policy involved. And
right, but
only when people are buying with cash can they avoid paying the lender's portion of that policy. And I know that it's kind of a different situation in different parts of the country as to who is paying whom. But these fees that you're talking about as commission or closing cost type fees, some of them are completely not in an agent's control. Well, here to explain a little bit more about that luxury piece is Jeff Bebach from Frontgate Real Estate, a big team at Compass that is a luxury top producing team in Southern California, a little north of LA for me, up in the hills of Calabasas, right? That's where you're at, Jeff, right?
With a little, a little Southern slang to it, but sure.
Well, they're like cowboys up there.
I know.
So Parker and I were just talking about the model that he's created for Housewell, and I wanted to bring you in to talk about how this type of model might challenge the luxury traditional broker. So since you're in that space, can you tell me, please, what you think is irreplaceable about the service that a traditional brokerage provides at the luxury level?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I've been around the rodeo here a couple of times being up here in Calabasas, but I've seen different iterations from help you sell the purple bricks and, different servicing type of discount brokerages, which is great. God bless them. I mean, I think that if it works, it's awesome. But I don't know, it's kind of the difference if, let's say you get in a car accident, right?
Like, oh, God.
Am I gonna get what I pay for? Let's say if it's a nasty situation, am I gonna call Sweet James or Gloria Albright? I have the right to choose and pay for the service and the level of service for, of what I think could be the coverage. It's really up to your right to, as far as what you wanna pay for, you get what you pay for. So if you want to discount attorney to a discount, to a killer attorney, great. Or if I was in the music industry before, if I wanted a crappy business manager that took care of me but didn't take care of me to one that was going to really take care of me, then, you know, I think that's the difference of it. Anything crappy. I'm just saying that that's just, you get what you pay for, you know?
One of the things you mentioned, Parker, was it's a quality versus quantity model. You didn't say quality, but you did say quantity. And I've heard this before. James Dwiggins, the co-CEO of Next Home, I was watching him give a talk at Reimagine Conference. And he said, listen, AI is not going to replace you, but it is going to replace a portion of your job. And that piece that becomes more efficient, right, is going to actually diminish your income. So you're going to need to do more sales to get the same amount of of volume. Why, as an agent yourself and as the founder of this property, of this company, why would you want to create a model that that makes us work three times as hard for the same amount of money?
Sorry, could you repeat that last one?
Is that a question for me or Jeff?
For you, Parker.
Okay.
So, like I said, I think that we offer somewhat different products. Like, our niche is with these fix and flippers with recurring revenue. I totally, like I said, not anti-agent. I think the more unique the property, the more valuable the agent. So when you're selling another home in a planned community in a suburb, and there's 40 different comps that sold over the last year, it's a pretty straightforward process. Pricing the home, getting good professional photos, putting a sign in the yard, like we know. But if you're selling a home that's on 5 acres outside of Aspen, Colorado, or, you know, a mountain home in Calabasas, California, maybe there's a lot more uniqueness, and it's harder to price the property, and the locality matters more. So I think it's just about providing a properly tiered services for people based on exactly what they need. And I've, you know, grown up, I think the biggest problem of my generation might be housing unaffordability. So anything that we can do to provide a great product to people who need it and make housing more affordable, that's sort of what compelled us to start this business.
But to that question, to that point, do you actually think that housing affordability is a result of agent commissions? Is it my job
I don't think that's causing the housing?
I don't think so either.
No. It's a small piece. I feel like I can influence.
Yeah, it's a piece. But if the discount is costing the consumer some money that's left on the table, I can tell you this because as a broker for 14 years, I have, and I love it when real estate agents say how long they've been in the business, because somebody was like, it's always a sign that they're going to be a jerk or something. But I actually think it's a sign of like, I've survived a few of these. I've survived some cycles, and I've battle scars, you know, I have battle scars. I can speak to some of this stuff. Two things. One, I invented a company called Evolution with a partner, and it was a broker, like lawyer model brokerage that had broker level service at like $1,000 an hour, and then a la carte service all down the line of the things that are more menial tasks, like, you know, as opening escrow, listing prep, like whatever. There'd be a different fee for the agent that provides those type of services than the higher end stuff, which was also a quantity model, and it failed. And the reason why I know it failed is because at a certain price point, people want concierge service. They don't want a random agent showing the property. They want somebody with a track record. And so I realized, okay, nobody who has a lot of money wants to walk into a clothing store and be like, you can have arms on your shirt for an extra $5. Like, no. Like, they want the full package. Like, here's what I want. You do your thing. Bring me an offer. You know, that's what they want. Jeff, how do you in your market compete with like innovation narratives? Is it a challenge for you right now, or do you feel like the traditional model's working for you in your market? It's not even a threat.
You know, every day I wake up, there's a threat, to be honest with you. You know, but having said that, I love AI. I love what, you know, the ease of scaling ability, and for what it's done, even for the back end. I haven't let one person go. I just enhanced their work, and I was able to expand and scale faster. And that was awesome, and that saved me. You know, I kind of look at it this way. So yes, I 100% agree with Parker, like with operationally and scaling, yes, AI, everything could be cut and dry and it can go through there. But every deal I've ever done, there's no such thing as a straightforward deal. I could do a first-time home buyer in a $500,000 house compared to a $5 million house. And if that HOA is screwed up because of whatever reason from a lawsuit, or they couldn't get insurance or blah, 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 that's what they really pay us for. And I don't know any other states, but in the state of California, where there is no attorneys, you know, we are trained almost to be to the level of almost being an attorney. And I don't know an attorney alive that would want to do what we do cheaper, because it's a lot of work. And once you get
it's
into
a lot of work.
Oh my God. I mean, and it's also that higher level of service. Like, I mean, you know, we're also psychologists, for God's sake. And there's a lot of that going on in almost every transaction from...
Yeah, we did mention that. We talked about that for a second because Parker brought that up as one of the qualities of agents that are irreplaceable. What I'm wrestling with, and I appreciate you being a good sport about it, Parker, because... You know, again, as someone who's kind of dabbled in a disruptor, creating a disruptive brokerage years ago that did not go anywhere, and you're making yours profitable, my strong concern is that it's turning, home-baked bread into store-bought, like, Wonder Bread. Like, we're taking something that actually does have experience, depth, psychology, it's a real profession, and he's right. In not every state involves attorneys, so we're at the end of really deeply understanding the contract in a way that protects our clients that some other states might not be. So maybe that's a thing, but you know, my concern is that it's watering it down to the point where if everything trends in this direction and our industry doesn't take a stand for the value that we actually serve, the expertise that we have to offer, the actual years of experience that I have opening doors, but not just that, negotiating the transactions, jumping lender hurdles, helping people through the psychological challenges, that everybody's going to lose. So it really makes it does that make Housewell scalable? If the agents serving the open houses are show me agents that are not quality controlled, and if the main people who are your clients are like just this niche, like just some investors, people, I have investors too who really don't need agents. They've been through it a million times. On the buy side, they don't really need an agent. On the sell side, I think 100% they do. But you know, is it scalable? Could it take over the industry? What you're doing?
I don't think it will. Honestly, We don't have any investors, so fortunately I can say stuff like that. I think it's going to be a good, like Josh and I have put a lot of work into building a good business, and we're going to keep growing this business. But I don't think in 10 years everyone's going to be using Housewell. I think a larger percentage will be using probably services like ours, but I don't think I really believe in independent brokers and local brokers. I'm pushing more back up against the sort of megalodons of the industry than anything.
So you're on our team?
I don't know if that answers your question. I don't think we're on different teams.
We are. Oh, we are. Don't fool yourself. This is not a kumbaya. Compass has just taken over, like either, and it's actually the last question that I have for you guys, and unfortunately I'm running out of time, but you know, Compass and the Anywhere merger are interesting because it is either the future of residential brokerage is going to be directed by these choices that Refkin makes, whether it's pulling out of NAR or everybody on the private listing network, including all these other franchises now, or even company-owned offices. Or we're going to go the direction of more tech forward platforms like yours. Like it's one or the other. Where, if each of you can, and Jeff, you can take this first, and then Parker, I'd love to hear your answer as well as we wrap. What is your prediction for what real estate brokerage is going to look like 5 years from now?
Man, my crystal ball is really broke in the last 10 years, but I could take a semi-guess. I mean, I think the acceleration of AI, and just from what I'm seeing it from the perspective of just scalability and what it can do, it's going to definitely speed up processes. It's going to make room for startups like Parker's to find a space in that. However, having said that, if you're going to have, everyone's just worried about monopolies. We're worried about Zillow as a monopoly. We're worried about Compass as a monopoly. And, you know, and it just becomes overwhelming and consuming. But what most people aren't really realizing right now that there's 1.5 million real estate agents, and I think it was 70% of them did not do one transaction last year. And it's right. Not about tech, it's about insurability, it's about, you know, the typical geopolitics and everything. But in the whole country, I think all of our biggest enemies is, to be honest with you, we're really struggling with the MLSs, we're struggling with NAR. You know, and they're going to get a real kick in the pants when they see how many agents bail out because they can't afford to pay this, and they make money off the MLSs, and they gave the keys away to that so that Zillow and everybody else had an entry point.
Oh yeah,
you know.
Oh, we've been sold down. Believe me, I was yelling about that into my living room into an empty room for years,
Me too.
Parker, what do you think? 5 years from now, what does residential real estate brokerage look like, that business? What's that look like?
Well, yeah, y'all are going to get me started down a rabbit hole about my dream of a national open source MLS that isn't for profit. But my vision, yeah, I think that would be awesome. But fewer agents, more professional agents. Each agent, I think, will make more money and yet still charge less commission. And I'm a big believer in local independent brokerage. I don't think the big brands create the value. I think it's really your personal brand that creates the value as the agent and your expertise. And they'll have their own sort of, they'll be better tech that helps run independent brokerages to a T, and they'll do more transactions, but might have to cut down on the commissions a little bit at the margin.
That's a great place to leave it. Thank you both so much for joining me. And I would love to have you guys back on another episode of The Clean Close.
Sounds great. Thanks, Courtney. Nice to meet you.
All right, thanks. Bye, guys. This week, the Fed also announced a rate cut, but interest rates went up? Yeah. Jerome Powell warned the December rate cut is not certain either, and the Dow absorbed the news. So don't expect relief anytime soon when it comes to these interest rates. One analyst quoted in an Inman piece said, if the Fed holds steady into Q1, the spring market may be the leanest we've seen in a decade. So the portals are fighting. The brokers are fighting. The agents are mutinying. And the Fed is tightening. It's the perfect storm for a reset. It's already here. For some, I think it's going to be a reckoning. And for some, maybe like Parker, it's going to be the opportunity of a lifetime. And I like the dream that he has, actually. Open source MLS nationally. And I like the dream of the working group at NAR, like reducing our fees. Come on, guys. Why are you hoarding the money, subjecting us to lawsuits, and not even delivering us on any transparency? Sounds kind of like the federal government, to be fair. But either way, the brokerage model that we have all known is likely and already going to change. Big thanks to Parker Bryant of Housewell for joining us, for Jeff Bebach of Frontgate Real Estate for joining us. This is The Clean Close, where we talk about real estate until our mouths fall off. We'll see you next time.